I want to take a look at the history of the English Bible, and to do that, of course, it's such a huge story. I'd like to keep it fairly short and just focus especially on the steps leading up to the King James Version, such a powerful translation. It's meant so much to the language itself, to our language. It's meant so much to millions of people. It probably had more impact than any other version of the language. Well, we could start with John Wycliffe in the 14th century, in the last years of the 14th century. He was convinced that the people needed a Bible in their own language, and he did translate both the Old and the New Testaments into the English of his day. He was using the 4th century Latin Vulgate of St. Jerome. By the way, that Vulgate, the word Vulgate sounds vulgar. No, it just means common language. So he did translate, but the problem was his translation was in a manuscript. There's no printing. It was 100 years before printing. So it was hard to circulate. They did make some copies of it, but didn't have a lot of influence. The story was that people offered to give up a load of hay for just a few chapters of St. Paul in English. But we want to move along past him. That was in the 1300s there, in the last part of the 14th century. It's really into the 1500s that we see the advance made by a certain William Tyndale. And I don't know if you've heard of him before, but I love this saying attributed to him. He said, "I would to God the plowman would sing a text of the scriptures at his plowbeam, and that the weaver at his loom with this would drive away the tediousness of time. I would the wayfaring man with this pastime would expel the weariness of his journey." Now, you can probably tell from that what Tyndale wanted was not just a Bible so that the priests could enjoy it and the clergy, but that the ordinary person would be able to, quote, sing a text of the scriptures at his plowbeam. So he wanted the average person to enjoy the Bible. So Tyndale came along, and he was known, actually, I think it's a great line here, he was called the father of the English Bible. And so we'll pick up the story here in the 1520s. He was a student first at Oxford and at Cambridge, a teacher, and then he was a preacher. And he had some views that got himself in trouble because he had advanced ideas of what church should be like. And he criticized the ignorance of the English clergy, got himself in trouble with church authority. He asked the Bishop of London permission in 1523 to translate the New Testament into English. But nobody gave him the permission, so he went to Germany in 1524, worked in Hamburg and Cologne, and was in trouble immediately with people that didn't want to see the Bible translated. They would be enemies of Luther, enemies of Protestantism, who depended on the Bible, and he had to escape from there to the Protestant city of Worms. And in 1526, he got to see the first printing of his New Testament completed, his translation, in England. He was still outlawed, and so were the copies outlawed, but they were smuggled into the... After he finished the New Testament, translated that, Tyndale started in on the Old. But you can imagine how big that was and how difficult. And he was able to get the first five books translated. That'd be the five books of Moses. He did a translation of the book of Jonah, but that was it. That was all he was able to do, because keep in mind, all this time, he's being tracked down. He's being chased. There are people that are trying to turn him in. They were hostile to the spread of Protestantism on the continent. And he was finally caught. It's a terrible story, a sad story. Somebody that he trusted actually betrayed him, turned him in. And so at this point, this would be 1536, near Brussels, he's put to death. And his last words are, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." I can imagine facing that kind of a death. I would be so full of anger, but he was pleading for the King of England to be aware of what's going on. And actually, it was this work of Tyndale that was the foundational work that the King James Version was based on. And now, of course, keep in mind what's going on outside of the translating is that we have a major split occurring. England is separating from the Church of Rome. That happens in 1534. And once that happens, there's a growing demand for a Bible in English. Well, along comes somebody named Miles Coverdale, who was a Yorkshireman by birth. And he was the next translator, and he was still a little concerned, even though they said, it's okay, you can do a Bible in English. He thought, no, this isn't going to work. So the first printed Bible that he oversaw and translated, he did in Zurich, which was, of course, one of the heartbeats of Protestantism. That was 1535. And this time it's the Old and the New Testament. So he did the two, and he had this... called the Coverdale Bible, and by 1537 it was actually being printed in England. And we owe that translation some nice things here. He had some odd translations, but especially when you compare it to the King James. For example, if you take Isaiah 60, let me share that with you here. The first verse, the King James says, "Arise, shine, for thy light is come." Well, here's what Coverdale said: "Get thee up, be illuminated." All right, so that's not as good, but at least you can see where the King James people took it. And yet he had some really nice lines. It was Coverdale that gave us things like, "The valley of the shadow of death, thou anointest my head with oil, they that sow in tears shall reap in joy." So we owe him some things as well. In fact, that was the first Bible, as I said before. Well, now there's more eagerness in England for a better translation. In 1539 comes something called the Great Bible. He edited this, and it was a lot of Tyndale's influence. And again, it was a predecessor to the King James Version. It was the first Bible that they were actually asked to use for the churches, and so it became adopted. In fact, apparently the rendering of the Psalms, which was Coverdale's work, for a couple hundred years was being used in the Church of England, even into the 20th century, and the Protestant Episcopal Church. It was really the first English Bible that the people, the common people, were given. So it was pretty powerful. Well, along comes the next person running England, that'd be Queen Mary. You may have heard of Bloody Mary, and she was a Catholic queen, so the printing of Bibles came to a standstill. So we get these stops and starts. And because she had so many Protestants put to death, a lot of them bailed out of England, including Miles Coverdale, and they escaped to the continent. And a colony of them, later known as the Puritans, settled in Geneva. And then they came up with the next translation. It was called the Geneva Bible. And keep in mind, these are the Puritans that have done this. So this is going to be a very Protestant, Puritan-oriented Bible. It was a small Bible, but it was the one that was used in all English homes until superseded by the King James Version. It was the first one that used that familiar Roman type. It was the first volume in English to divide the text into verses. It even had italics to show any addition to the original text, which is still used today. But the nice thing is it was honored. It was a predecessor to the King James Version. And it took things like, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." It took lines like this and turned these out. "O Zion, thou bringest good tidings, get thee up into the high mountain." And keep in mind that this version, this Geneva version, was by the group of people that founded this country, the Puritan colony of Massachusetts Bay. So it was pretty popular. This Geneva Bible swept the land. Well, the bishops, the high ups in the Church of England, were not real crazy about this, because keep in mind, it had a lot of notes to it, the marginal notes, that sounded a whole lot like Calvinism, way too Protestant, heavy, right-wing Protestant stuff for the Church of England. So they wanted another Bible to come out, and this is called the Bishop's Bible, 1568. And it's fine. It led us also to the King James Version. The next one was the Roman Catholics, who now are feeling like they need to have their own translation. They have one called the Douai translation because of a French town. So that came out in 1582. That would be the New Testament. 1593, the Old Testament. And it rested again on that Latin Vulgate of St. Jerome. So they didn't go back to the original Hebrew and Greek. Keep that in mind. Most of these are coming out of that Vulgate, which itself is a translation of the original Hebrew and Greek. And so they're not really using great tactics to make this as close to the original language as possible. All right, let's pick up with the King James Version, and what's going on with that one? Well, King James comes to the throne. He's the son of Mary, Bloody Mary. Remember, after Bloody Mary, of course, we had the famous Queen Elizabeth, and she dies without an heir. So King James, who is Mary's son living up in Scotland, is the next king. And so he realizes when he ascends the throne that they could use another Bible besides this Geneva Bible. There's way too much dangerous Calvinism in there. And so they decide we need to do something about it. And they have a conference. And the king is enthused about this. He appoints 54 learned men who had skill in Hebrew and Greek. So do you hear that? Not just Latin. Let's go back to the original languages, Hebrew and Greek, for the new translation. And these people were not chosen because they were yes men or suck-ups to the king or anything like that. They were chosen very carefully for their learning and their intelligence, and included both Church of England people as well as Puritans. It was a very careful way that they went about this translation. They divided them up into six companies, each company having nine men. Two companies worked at Cambridge, two at Oxford, and two at Westminster. So they weren't next to each other. Each one was apportioned a new portion, assigned a portion of the Bible. And so they were responsible. So this is a group effort, not individual effort. Now, we know some of the people. We don't know a lot of them. But the main one on the list is a man named Lancelot Andrews. And he was Dean of Westminster. He was a bishop. He was a likable person, a learned man. Somebody once said there wasn't enough learning in the world to know how learned he was. And so he was fascinated with this whole translation thing. He knew several languages. And they set to work on this. Somebody wondered how long it took. I mean, it was, you know, years. So did they get paid? Well, we really don't know, but apparently they at least got board and lodging when they worked on this thing. And the proposal came out in 1604, but they really didn't get started until 1607, and it took them 4 years, and they finally came up with it in 1611. Now, if you have a chance, take a look at one of the original front pages, the dedication page dedicated to the king. It's just really interesting because it's during the time where they all had to worry a little bit about what the king thought about them. You know, it's off with their heads kind of thing. So it really oozes people who are nervous about what the king may say. And so it's very complimentary to the king. Well, all right, so they come up, they've used Hebrew and they've used Greek. It was a great time to write this because they did take it back to this original, these two languages. And, of course, the English language during this time was in a fresh and flexible stage. Think about Shakespeare, right? We're talking about the Shakespearean language. People are excited to be alive. There's some adventure in the air. And so they came out of a time of terrible suffering in the 1500s with all the deaths and martyrs and Catholics in, and then the Protestant are in, and then people are fleeing to the continent. So they came out of this tremendous chaos and background, the suffering, and finally came to pass. And one person at the time called it the noblest monument of English prose. And I thought, as a way to end, let me share with you a Coverdale, a Geneva, a Bishop's, and then the King James version of the of one passage, so you can hear the differences. So we'll move from the oldest to the King James. So here's the Coverdale version of this one. This is a famous passage in Isaiah. A fourth chapter, fourth verse of chapter 2 of Isaiah. Here's Coverdale. So that they shall break their swords and spears to make scythes, sickles, and saws thereof. From that time forth shall not one people lift up weapon against another, neither shall they learn to fight from thenceforth. Here's the Geneva version of this. They shall break their swords also into mattocks, and their spears into scythes. Nations shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn to fight any more. What does the Bishop's Bible say? Here it is. They shall break their swords into mattocks, and their spears to make scythes. And one people shall not lift up a weapon against another, neither shall they learn to fight from thenceforth. Okay, well, here's the King James Version. This is the one, I believe, that's in front of the United Nations building. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Did you notice, for example, they got rid of things like thenceforth and mattox, and it's a smoother, cleaner, more flowing, I would say, translation. Here's a short one that is from Job 38. Coverdale. When the morning stars gave me praise and when all the angels of God rejoiced. Geneva Version. When the stars of the morning praised me together and all the children of God rejoiced. Bishop's Version. When the morning stars praised me altogether and all the children of God rejoiced triumphantly. King James Version. When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Isn't that a nicer line there, that when the morning stars sang together? That sounds better than when the morning stars praised me together. They sang. It's so positive. It's a nice line that they use there. So that gives you an idea of some of the changes that happened up to the King James. Certainly after that, there's a proliferation of different translations. In the textbook I provide for the students, I have more information of what happened after the King James, but I'll just stop with that point. The King James, of course, is the Bible that was carried across the ocean and started showing up on these shores in America. It was the foundational book that people for hundreds of years memorized and knew. I mean, I grew up on the King James Version, so even into the 20th century, this was the most popular translation around. It's been replaced, and rightly so. Somebody once said, I only give the translation, the King James translation, to somebody who's 300 years old, meaning the language has changed a lot. And they've discovered many more manuscripts, older manuscripts, that are far more accurate to the original. So I'm not saying we have to hang on to the King James. I'm not suggesting it's the only good translation. I'm not suggesting that you should read it. I wouldn't. I don't read it anymore. It is beautiful. It has a flow of the language there. But the point is, it was such an impactful translation for that time.